want to greet you this morning in Jesus' name. The one who gave himself for the church, the one who wants to sanctify it and cleanse it and wash it with the washing of the water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. It's a blessing to be here this morning. It was a blessing to be challenged to walk with God and to have these examples of the old patriarchs who walked with God set before us, and to sit in our Sunday school class. The only way that I can make sense out of these things is by Paul's words, where he says that we look not at the things which are seen, which are temporal, but the things which are not seen, which are eternal. So there is a life beyond this life that makes this life worth living. So it was just a real blessing to be here. I would have a couple of excuses not to preach the sermon I want to preach about this morning, I suppose. The one is that it's perhaps geared towards a pretty narrow audience. I like a sermon that can be received broadly, but I hope that this sermon can be accepted by everyone and everyone can learn a lesson from it. The other thing is that I don't feel like I'm qualified to preach it because I'm right in the middle of what I want to preach about. It would be much easier to have someone who has, don't want to say fought this fight, not quite, maybe who has walked the road instead of someone who is walking the road. I would like to hear someone who has walked the road preach this sermon. Or perhaps it'd be easier if you'd be a young person and be idealistic and would have all these dreams and ideals ahead of you and wouldn't have had the reality and the day-to-day grind, having jerked the carpet out from under you and you have to face reality sometimes. But so perhaps I am qualified because I'm one of you and I'm right in the middle of it. What I want to preach about is how that us as parents, us as fathers and mothers, or us as fathers and you as mothers, can cultivate a respect in our children for the brotherhood. Now, when I say cultivate, what I'm trying to do is not talk about what we do to corn and to fields, but to encourage and to foster and to try to acquire or to try to have our children develop a respect. Now, when I'm talking about respect, I'm talking about something that is a feeling of admiration. This is the definition that I found that I liked, is a feeling of deep admiration for someone or something that's elicited by their abilities or qualities or achievement. So what I think that we should have is, what I want to do is to develop a respect for the church because of her qualities. A feeling of deep admiration for the church because of her qualities. So I'd like to start, and I'll just read this psalm. You don't have to turn there, but this is a very famous psalm when we think about parents and children. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ear to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he had established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the generation which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. So the vision in this passage here is that there are perhaps as old as great-grandfathers and grandfathers and fathers and children, all perhaps in a line standing there. I don't know how you want to envision that in your head, but there's four or five generations pictured here setting their hope in God and not forgetting the works of God, but they keep his commandments. So, to cultivate is to To cultivate your garden is to feed and to nourish the crop that you want to grow and to remove the things that you don't want, because they're going to use the moisture and the nutrients of the things that they're going to take the moisture and the nutrients away from the crop that you want to grow. So to cultivate is to create a good environment. And so respect is deference, and it's an admiration for the body of Christ because of her qualities. Some of the synonyms to respect are revere and reverence and honor. Now, I would like to start off with the church's qualities. And I think that'd probably be a good place to start, because we want to develop a respect for her because of her qualities. We want to develop and foster in our children a admiration for the bride of Christ. We know that the church is made of everyone who has truly repented and has been rightly baptized and is following the Master. It is the dwelling place of God. It is the dwelling place of God. The church is the dwelling place of God. I noticed, and I'm not trying to pick bones, but I noticed twice this morning somebody used the term house of God this morning, as in the building. Well, it's probably not technically right. Technically speaking, the church is the house of God, the dwelling place of God. It is built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, of which Jesus Christ himself is the chief cornerstone. That's the group of people that Christians are a part of, or that Christians make up. But it also seems that though this church is vast and it's worldwide, but that there's a local aspect to the church, a local body of believers who have committed themselves together in a disciplined, responsible, and accountable relationship with each other. And I'm not sure how you want to put that all together. And it doesn't, that's not what I'm talking about this morning. How that our body here, if you please, relates to the body at large. But there is a local aspect to the church. Our lives are bound by the new covenant that was made by Jesus as he came to show us the Father's will, and as he sacrificed himself, the eternal sacrifice for our sins. We can say no more and no less than what he and his apostles have already said. But we believe that what he left us is best understood, and in fact, it is only understood, it is meant to be understood and practiced in a community of believers. And just exactly how this community functions together, it's not clearly spelled out for us. But there are overarching principles of a common faith, a common love, and of submission to each other that the community of believers must function by. I wasn't sure if I... Why don't you turn to 1 Corinthians 10? I don't know if I'll read this, but just skim over this. I want to bring your attention to some of the qualities of the church. In verse 16, it says, "The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we being many are made..." But "we being many are one bread and one body, for we are all partakers of that one bread." So this word that is translated here, communion, can be translated different ways. And another way that it's translated is in 1 John, it's translated fellowship. So the fellowship that we have is around the body of Christ, around the blood of Christ. And we are one bread. We have been made one bread. And we are all one partakers of that one bread. So just looking down through here, he goes on to describe this body as a place where everyone, this is in verse 24, where everyone seeks the wealth of another. Every part of this body seeks the wealth or the benefit of the other part. Where nobody gives an offense to each other. That's down in verse 32. "Give none offense, neither to the Jews, nor to the Gentiles, nor to the church of God." So one of the things that this body strives to do as we are working together is that we give no offense to anyone. and that everything is done to the glory of God. All right, so that's a description of the body of the communion in 1 Corinthians 10. There's another description given by the Apostle John in 1 John, where John says, and you can turn here too, but I just want to skim over some things, where John says that how he is declaring to the reader and to us the things that the apostles witnessed of the word of life, so that we can have fellowship with them. Now imagine that. John is writing, and he wrote this down so that we can have fellowship with them. What he is saying, we can have fellowship with the apostles. And he says, he goes on to say, and truly our fellowship is with the Son. How does he say that? Is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. But this word fellowship here is also the same word that was translated communion back in 1 Corinthians 10. So this is the same, a description of the same body. It's the description of the same entity. But it's an amazing thought that we can have fellowship with the apostles. And that is because these things were written. I think that's fascinating. And I think God knew what he was doing when he got the apostles to write these things down. But this fellowship in 1 John, just skimming through 1 John, is described by walking in the light. Now we heard about that this morning already. Isn't that amazing? We heard about walking in the light. This fellowship is described by confession of sins. It's described by loving each other in deed and in truth. And that means in actuality and how we work together. It's described by not loving the world and by not believing every wind that blows, but by trying the spirits, whether they are of God. And this fellowship is described by victory over the world. That is the basis of fellowship as described by John in this first epistle. But then there is also the term brotherhood that is used by the Apostle Peter. And turn to 1 Peter 2. I want to start reading in verse 9. 1 Peter 2, verse 9. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but now are the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the king's sake, every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or as unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free, not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of Christ, the servants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. So here's that term brotherhood that I used in the beginning of the sermon, where we want to cultivate a respect for the brotherhood. But here are some descriptions of the brotherhood. They are a chosen generation. They are a kingly priesthood. They are a called out nation. They are a chosen, a peculiar, a called out people, so that they would show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which did not used to be a people of God, that did not even used to be a people, but now are the people of God. It was not even such an entity as that before, but now there is. Usually they were outside of the mercy of God, but now they have obtained mercy. They will abstain from fleshly lusts. Their lifestyle is upright, and they're obedient to civil authorities. When Peter tells us to love the brotherhood, it is this group of people that he's talking about. And it is this remarkable group of people that is close to God's heart. It is for this group of people that Jesus will be returning to receive as his bride. As the people of God were precious to him in the Old Testament, so his people in the New are precious to him. Zechariah wrote, "For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye." Now, I understand that in the ancient games played by the Greeks and the Romans, they had a no holds barred kind of wrestling, but they had only two restrictions: no eye gouging and no biting. All right? The eyes are a very precious and they're a very delicate and sensitive organ. The apple of your opponent's eye was off limits. And the apple of God's eye is off limits to his opponent as well. In 1 Corinthians 1 verse 6, Paul says that God sees it as a righteous thing to recompense tribulation on those who trouble you. It's almost as if those who trouble the church are a fly in God's eye, and he is vindicated by taking this thing out and dealing with it. He has reserved every right to get it out. Surely, since God views his people with such a protective passion, it's worth our regard and respect as well. All right, so that is the group of people. That is the body, the entity that we as parents want to cultivate respect in our children for. But now, why is this command given to parents? Why isn't it given to some other place? Well, the first reason is, I think, is that children need love. Children, God's design from the beginning is that children are conceived only in the bonds of a loving, committed marriage. That's the place where children are meant to be born into. Children need that love. They need both a father. They need both a father and a mother. They need nurture and discipline. And there is not an institution anywhere that can match the constant day in, day out care, nurture and discipline that a loving home can give. There is none anywhere. In 1996, Hillary Clinton, many of you know that name, wrote a book, It Takes a Village. This book promotes a social approach to child rearing. In other words, it takes a government-funded school. It takes government-funded daycare. It takes government-funded resources to raise a child. She said in this book, "I believe it is the primary role of the state to teach, train, and raise children. Parents have a secondary role." Beyond the obvious that children need to be taught and trained and raised, there is nothing in that statement that we can agree with. Parents have the primary responsibility, and I hope we can boldly say that the state has none. This is not the biblical way. As far as I know, even the church is nowhere commanded to teach and train children. This is a parental responsibility. Parents are responsible for their children. They are responsible for the environment that their children are in. They are responsible for the education their children receive. Now, there is certainly a blessing to be found when all the parents of the congregation have similar goals and similar expectations for their children. But the bottom line lies with parents to provide a healthy environment for their children. There is certainly a blessing to be found in a Christian school where a brotherhood can sponsor and organize a place to provide the education for the children in its midst, where there's teachers that we can trust, and where there's a curriculum that we can endorse, and where the school provides a safe place for our children to be away from us for a whole day. We find this a treasure, and we owe our God thanks for the privilege of living in a land where we can do this. And perhaps we owe our government something as well, maybe something called property taxes. I'm not sure how you want to deal with that, but I think so. But the bottom line responsibility of educating our children still lies with us as parents. Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 to 9. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. So this is the day in and the day out responsibilities of parents that no other institution anywhere else can perform. Now there's a few examples in the scriptures that portray a father's responsibility. I have a positive example here where Abraham was commended as one who would command his children after him. Genesis 18, God asked the question about, I guess to himself, about whether he should show Abraham what he's going to do to the city of Sodom. He says, the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham the things which I shall do? Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him. And they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. So Abraham is commended in some way because he's ruling over his house. He's taking responsibility for his household. But on the other hand, we have a couple examples of fathers who did not do their responsibility. The one is the high priest, the first high priest. I guess he wasn't the first. Aaron was the first high priest. An early high priest in the children of Israel, whose name was Eli. His sons were misusing the sacrifice. They were committing adultery with the women that came to serve in the tabernacle. And it seems that beside a mild rebuke, Eli seems to have tolerated his sons' misconduct. Another one is David. It says that he had a son named Adonijah. And it says Adonijah, the son of Haggith. Haggith was one of David's wives' names. Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, why hast thou done so? Also, he was a very goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom. So Adonijah was David's son, and he was planning on taking the throne after David was an old man. The story is kind of strange. I'll let you read it. It's in 1 Kings 1. But anyway, the idea is that Adonijah wanted to become king. But David wanted Solomon to become king, and so that's who David had anointed and set in place as king in Israel. And Solomon wasn't sure what to do with Adonijah, except he says, if he shows himself a worthy man, I will let him live. But when Adonijah, who had never been told no by his dad, wanted some of the kingly perks, if you please, then Solomon had him killed. But the problem is that Adonijah had never been told no. And it made a real problem. Proverbs 22, verse 6, that famous verse, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. To train means to create habits. That's really what it means. You can train a dog. You can train a cow. You can train all kinds of things. It means to teach a particular skill or type of behavior through practice and instruction over a period of time. So this is an ongoing thing. This is what they learn by habit. That's what it means to train. You can train lions and dogs and horses and cows, and you can train grapevines and roses, and you can train children. I know children are in a different category. They are created in the image of God, and to my chagrin, they inherit a lot from their dad as well. But anyway, one of the things is when they were created in the image of God, they have been given the gift of choice. They are not horses and they are not pumpkins. But yet, The command to bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord still stands. The command to train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, that still stands. So there's a responsibility that we have. I think that probably the highest goal of us in training our children, and what we mean by training is for them to become used to obedience, for them to become into the habit of obedience. I think the highest goal for us in training our children is for them to become receptive to the call of God in their lives. Now, there's a lot of wills here in this sentence that I will read here. Training them to yield their will to your will prepare the soil of their heart to yield their will to the will of God. Training them to yield their will to your will prepare the soil of their hearts to yield their will to the will of God. And I think that's the purpose for us to train our children. It's primarily so that when the call of God comes to their lives, that they will yield. Secondarily, it's also for them to be in practice to learn to submit to other authorities, whether that's school or church or civil or whatever other authority on the workplace or whatever authority that they may find over them. Now, I received my schooling at Crossroads Mennonite School, and it was run by Eastern Mennonites, and I have a great appreciation for what I learned there. But something that I learned there, or in my experience there, I learned from my dad, if you can understand that. I was used to wearing black or dark blue pants, and I think that was some of you's dress code at the time, and they were held up by suspenders, and I wore solid color dark shirts. Solid color shirts. All right? But what kind of shoes a person wore didn't really matter so much to us. It's just how we lived. But now when I went to school, my friends were all wearing plaid shirts and jeans that were held up with belts. But shoes were a big deal. There were no striped or too light colored shoes going to be treading those halls. It just wasn't going to happen. But it was a good experience for me to learn submission to legitimate authority outside of my home. As far as Dad was concerned, it was case closed. If I was going to Crossroads School, I was going to wear shoes that were going to be in subjection to their rules. And I was going to have a good attitude about it. So he was teaching me in that case how I need to subject myself to other authority, but that whole thing had been prefaced by him teaching me and training me to be subject to his authority. So this early training is God's way of helping people yield to his will when they become older. Now, some practical things. How can we help our children learn what it means to subject themselves? Now, I told Amanda last night I'm going to use this story. The first one is early discipline. I remember when she, our oldest child, was just at the age where I thought that she was old enough to sit still in church, and she disagreed with me quite heartily. All right? It was time to sit still, and she didn't want to. So during the sermon, I took her out a couple times, and I did what I had thought I needed to do. And by the end of the service, I was probably about as frazzled as she was. I told my wife that, and she said, well, she thinks she was probably about as frazzled as either one of us. So anyway, after church that Sunday morning, John Botter, whose death is just about 4 or 5 years away right now, He came to me and told me that I was doing the right thing. He had gone through this experience before, and he had known the blessing, the discipline can be both to the child and to its parents. But that encouragement meant so much to me. And I'd like to pass that on too. There was something that happened. And I'm sure many of you can testify to the same thing. That when that child learns just something, just as simple as sitting still, there's something that happens between you and her, between you and the child, that you're not going to get anywhere else. And so that child grows. But if you didn't do that, don't expect the church to do for your teenager what you failed to do when the child was sitting on your lap. So, early discipline. Secondly, parents. Fathers and mothers, please stand together in disciplining your children. Isaac and Rebecca are an example of the havoc that can be wreaked in a home when mom and dad aren't together. It says Isaac loved Jacob because he did eat of his venison, but Rebecca loved Jacob. And you know the stories, how that Esau kind of catered to his dad, and his dad loved him for it. And there was all this trickery and all these kinds of things going on in that home. It was just a problem. The animosity continued for centuries because of mom liking one and dad liking another. We cannot do that. Wives, mothers, you hold a tremendous influence by example and submission to your husbands. Make sure that the covering that you are wearing is the actual testimony of your life. The third thing I have is cultivate an atmosphere of joy in your home. Joy is a fruit of the Spirit of God in your life. A lack of joy is an indication of you're not yielding to the Spirit of God who lives in you. But this has very practical things. Just things like after you're done disciplining a child, part with a smile. Things come, things happen in homes where there's tension. Fathers, I think we have a responsibility to diffuse these things. And the problem is sometimes us as fathers are the problems. So if there is no joy in us and we have anger and bitterness in our lives, these things grow and they multiply and our children catch on to these things. When there is an atmosphere of joy in a place, that's a place where I like to be in, and that's a place where your children can grow and thrive. So cultivate an atmosphere of joy. The fourth thing I have is sometimes more is caught than taught. Our passions become obvious to our children. I remember once driving into a place where my wife's older brother Merv was, and many of you know him, where him and his family was. Their oldest son, Zach, he was probably 5, 6, or 7, something like that. And we pulled in there in the Suburban that we have. And this was 10 years ago, or however old he was. He was 5 or 6 or 7, something like that. And he casts a really analytical, critical eye on that Suburban and pulls himself up to all his little boy wisdom and said, "We don't like Chevys." Now, his dad isn't that much of a diehard that it has to be one truck over another. But somehow this little guy caught the idea that his dad likes Fords because his dad had a Ford van and a Ford pickup. All right? So we don't like Chevys. Young minds are very impressionable. See, there's a reason that you don't find John Deere toys at the international dealership. See, we make impressions on them without saying a word. And somehow they can sense attitudes in us that we barely know are there. But we can impress on them a love for the church, or the feeling that somehow the church just isn't quite what it should be. Now, over the top, we will always say, sure, I'm supportive. But our children can tell. I don't know how. They just know us better than we know ourselves sometimes. But see, the church, it isn't quite what it should be. You're fair enough when you say that. At least not on this side of eternity, it's not. But yet, it is God's kingdom. And it is God's way of making His glory known to the world around us. And it is the people for whom Christ is coming again. There is a glory about the church that we should be enthused about and passionate about. So sometimes more is caught than taught. The other thing I have is cultivate respect by example. And this is just right the same line. But how can we expect our children to respect the brotherhood when we don't? So often we're kind of like Goldilocks, and we're looking for porridge that's not too hot and not too cold, a chair that's not too big or not too little, a bed that's not too hard and not too soft. So we find ourselves, and the church is either too conservative or it's too liberal. There are too many different ideas, or everyone thinks alike. There's too many people of the same heritage, or there's so much variety. Either the ministers think they can get into everybody's business, or they're too slack. See, you can always find something of too little or too much. You can always find too much or too little of something or the other. But see, we're not testing porridge. We're not Goldilocks. What we're happening is we are embittering our children to the preciousness of the bride of Christ. So, how do you deal with these things? I'm not sure. It takes a lot of grace. It takes a lot of forbearance and compassion. It just does. Another thing is endorse the things that she stands for. The new covenant is timeless and binding. It is pertinent. It is relevant. It is relevant for us. And we must practice its teachings. And I did say this, that we are not given the authority to prescribe more or less than what it requires. But yet it is clear that the best interpretation, the best application of its teachings is done in a brotherhood setting. And here's where things usually get interesting. There are different ways that the teachings of the new covenant can be applied. And we set a good example for our children, and we do them a tremendous favor by taking for ourselves the things that a scriptural brotherhood has agreed to. And the last one I have is to make yourself available. There's a lot to do in a church this size. Be a willing volunteer. Have a cheerful response when asked to do something. If it's teaching Sunday school, or if it's being on the sewing committee, or if it's organizing Bible school, or whatever it is, your children will soon pick up if you have a "do I have to" attitude or "I'll do it all for Jesus" attitude. I use those two things because of our time at Faith Mission. There was one boy there who, that was his response, is "do I have to?" And another boy's response was, as he was mopping the floor, he made up his own song, his own version and verses of "I'll do it all for Jesus." Your response to when you're asked for a job, your attendance and your promptness will tell a lot about your enthusiasm for something. But all of these things are rooted at a heart level about our attitude towards the church, and our children pick up on these things. I have a poem I'd like to read in closing. It's a prayer. It's actually a song in our books, but I don't think we ever sang it here. "Shine Thou upon us, Lord." "Shine Thou upon us, Lord, true light of men today, and through the written word Thy very self display. That so from hearts which burn with gazing on Thy face, Thy little ones may learn the wonders of Thy grace. Breathe Thou upon us, Lord, thy Spirit's living flame, that so with one accord our lips may tell thy name. Give thou the hearing ear, fix thou the wondering thought, that those we teach may hear the great things thou hast wrought. Speak thou for us, O Lord, in all we say of thee. According to thy word, let all our teaching be, so that thy lambs may know their own true shepherd's voice, where'er he leads them go, and in his love rejoice. Live thou within us, Lord, thy mind and will be ours. Be thou beloved, adored, and served with all our powers, so that our lives may teach thy children what thou art, and plead by more than speech for thee with every heart.